I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's December 31st, and we have a lot to talk about. My guest today is Mark Boyer. Mark raised over $160,000 for the MS Society of Canada by biking more than 4,000 miles from one end of Canada to the other. Canada has one of the highest rates of multiple sclerosis in the world, and Mark not only raised money that will fund important MS research, his coast-to-coast ride also raised awareness about MS throughout Canada. I should also mention that Mark doesn't have MS, nor does anyone in his family. So we're going to talk about what motivated Mark to take on a 4,000-mile bike ride for MS and what he learned along the way. But before we get to my conversation with Mark Boyer, there are a few other things that you should know about. If you're a longtime listener, then you know that as an MS activist, I believe that advocating on your own behalf, on behalf of the issues that directly affect you and your family, is not only an incredibly empowering act, but it's also an important aspect of living in a democracy. It's about choosing to participate in shaping the society in which we all live. And since this is the last day of 2019, it seems like the right time to look back at our MS advocacy efforts here in the United States. And if I was going to sum up 2019, I'd call it a very good year for federal legislation in support of MS research, a reasonably good year for legislation aimed at managing the cost of prescription drugs, and a not-so-great year when it came to the politics that affected some critical aspects of healthcare. So when it comes to the issues that impact people affected by MS, let's take a look at what actually happened in 2019. As I just mentioned, it was a very good year for MS research funding priorities. The appropriations bills passed in both houses of Congress and signed by the President increased funding for the MS research program at the Department of Defense by $10 million, going from $6 million in 2019 to $16 million in 2020. The budget to fund biomedical research at the National Institutes of Health was increased by $2.6 billion, going from $39.1 billion in 2019 to $41.7 billion in 2020. And clearly, MS research isn't the only research that's funded by the National Institutes of Health. But the NIH is an important source of MS research funding, so it's always good news when we see an increase in that particular budget. The National Neurologic Conditions Surveillance System at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention received $5 million in funding to continue implementing their pilot projects focused on Parkinson's disease and multiple sclerosis. Now, this project has been a long time coming, but it will eventually provide researchers with the kinds of detailed geographic and demographic data about MS that has never existed before. The Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, known as PCORI, was reauthorized for the next 10 years. We talked about the need for PCORI to be reauthorized just a couple of episodes ago, so this is very good news. PCORI has already funded approximately $70 million in MS research to help determine which treatments work best for which MS patients and under what circumstances. Now, I'm particularly glad to see PCORI reauthorized. Just before the holidays, I was named a PCORI ambassador. So in the coming year, we'll be talking more about the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute and the importance of including patient-centered outcomes in MS research. Now, when it comes to getting some kind of a handle on what appears, at least from the outside looking in, like the perpetually skyrocketing costs of MS prescription drugs, there was also some good legislative news. The Creating and Restoring Equal Access to Equivalent Samples Act of 2019, better and more easily known as the CREATES Act, was signed into law. Now, the CREATES Act makes it easier for generic drug companies to obtain the necessary samples of brand name drugs in order to create lower priced generics. And although it wasn't a bill that got signed into law because it hasn't yet made it to a Senate vote, and may never make it to a Senate vote, we should also mention that the House of Representatives passed the Elijah E. Cummings Lower Drug Costs Now Act of 2019. And again, this bill did not become a law, but I think it's worth mentioning because it represents an important first step toward getting the price of prescription medications under control. Specifically, the bill empowers Medicare to negotiate with drug manufacturers on the prices of up to 250 different medications. Now, Medicare covers 60 million Americans, so the price that Medicare pays for drugs has huge market implications. Just a few months ago, we talked about a study that showed that between the years 2006 and 2016, the cost of MS medication for Medicare patients increased sevenfold, raising the total Medicare price tag for MS medications from $19 million in 2006 to almost $150 million in 2016. So allowing Medicare to negotiate on these prices would be a huge step forward. The Cummings Lower Drug Costs Now Act also requires that drug manufacturers justify any price increases that exceed 10% annually or 25% over 3 years. And the bill establishes a cap on out-of-pocket expense for drugs purchased under Medicare Part D. We'll keep an eye on the Elijah E. Cummings Lower Drug Costs Now Act in the coming year and see if it doesn't eventually gain traction in the Senate. So, when it comes to the cost of MS prescription drugs, we got a win with the passage of the CREATES Act, and we at least started the legislative conversation with the passage of the Cummings Lower Drug Costs Now Act in the House. Now, if you'd like to see how your congressional representatives in the House and Senate voted on each of the appropriation bills that were passed into law, you'll find a link to those congressional voting records in today's show notes, and you might want to check them out. And then either send an email thanking your representatives and senators for their support. And if your elected officials chose not to support you, you might want to keep that in mind and hold them accountable when you cast your vote in November. Let's turn our attention for a moment to some other aspects of healthcare that didn't get resolved in our favor this year. And we can start with surprise billing. If you're not familiar with surprise billing, here's how it works. Let's suppose your primary care doctor advises you that you need surgery. Now, your primary care doctor is probably your primary care doctor because he or she is part of the provider network that your insurance company has set up. The first thing most of us do when we choose our health insurance plans is we make sure that our doctor is in-network. In other words, our insurance company will cover our appointments and our treatment from our primary care doctor because they have a contract with him or her that spells out the rates that the insurance company will have to pay them. So now that you know you need surgery, the next thing you make sure of is that the surgeon who will perform the procedure and the hospital that you'll go to is also in network. In other words, they're also part of the provider network that your insurance company has set up. So having checked everything out in advance, you're set. You're covered. You have your surgery, and then a few weeks later, you get a bill that says after your insurance company has paid their portion of your expense, you still owe thousands of dollars. Well, how could this happen? After all, your doctor, your surgeon, the hospital itself, they were all in network, right? They were all covered by your insurance plan. But wait, what about that anesthesiologist, or that radiologist, or any other specialist who you may never have selected but nonetheless may have treated you during your hospital stay? Well, you come to find out that they weren't part of your insurance company's network, and so you're on the hook for all of the charges that they've billed while you're hospitalized. Worse yet, Imagine that you've just suffered a heart attack, and as they're loading you into an ambulance, you manage to say to the ambulance personnel, "Hey, be sure to take me to Hospital XYZ." And you say that because you know that Hospital XYZ is in your provider network. And the ambulance takes you to Hospital XYZ, and you're wheeled into the emergency room. And at that point, you lose consciousness. When you regain consciousness, you're doing much better. You've been treated, and you're on your way to making a full recovery. You're discharged from the hospital, and a few weeks later, you receive a bill for thousands of dollars. Because while the hospital emergency room was in your provider network, some of the specialists who worked on saving your life weren't. And since you were unconscious at the time, well, you never really had a choice about who'd be treating you. Now, some individual states already have laws on the books protecting patients from surprise billing. And this was a year that Congress was going to do something about protecting everyone. Because as divided as our legislators are about almost everything, when it comes to surprise billing, there was actually bipartisan support for taking this unexpected and unwelcome financial burden off the shoulders of patients and letting the hospitals, the specialists, and the insurance companies resolve it among themselves. But the bipartisan bill that was designed to put an end to surprise billing was delayed until next year. It seems the hospital industry was deeply opposed to the bill. And it's been reported that Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer worked behind the scenes in the Senate to raise objections to the bill and get it stalled, while Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wouldn't commit to bring the bill up to a Senate vote. So when it comes to surprise billing, the issue isn't going away. Stay tuned to 2020. There was also a bipartisan bill in the Senate that would have capped prescription drug prices in Medicare at the rate of inflation. And although the bill was backed by the White House, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell informed the White House that he wouldn't put the bill up for a Senate vote because a majority of Senate Republicans opposed it. And there was a very small detail in the spending bill that was approved that actually gave pharmaceutical companies an extended monopoly on a whole category of drugs. And this tiny detail is worth billions of dollars in future profits. So we're going to wade into science speak for just a second so I can tell you that the appropriations bill defined a specific drug category called chemically synthesized polypeptides as biologic drugs. And the difference here is that biologic drugs get 12 years of market exclusivity before it's legal to produce generic versions. And this 12-year period of exclusivity is 7 years longer than if those polypeptides were treated like any other small molecule drugs. So that's a major win for the pharmaceutical industry that will come at a cost to the consumers who pay for these prescription medications. In other legislative changes, Congress repealed three separate taxes that had been part of the Affordable Care Act. A tax on medical devices was repealed, largely due to very effective advocacy on the part of the medical device manufacturing industry. A tax on health insurance companies was repealed due to the very successful advocacy on behalf of the health insurance industry. And a tax on certain very high-cost health insurance plans, popularly known as a Cadillac tax, because it only applied to so-called Cadillac health insurance policies typically purchased by very wealthy individuals, was repealed due to the very successful lobbying efforts by labor unions. Now, collectively, these three taxes were projected to contribute $375 billion in tax revenue over the next 10 years. And that represents almost 25% of the entire $1.4 trillion spending bill that was signed into law. But perhaps the biggest political loss that was dealt to people affected by MS or any other chronic illness was delivered not by Congress, but by a U.S. federal appeals court this past December 18th, when it issued an opinion declaring the individual mandate that was part of the Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional. Now, some might say this isn't a political issue, but a judicial issue that's taking place in the courts and not in Congress. And I'd only point out that the original lawsuit seeking to declare the entire Affordable Care Act unconstitutional was filed by 20 Republican state attorneys general, and the appeal to protect the Affordable Care Act was initiated by 17 Democrat state attorneys general, which I think makes this pretty darn political. And the reason this matters so much to people affected by MS or any other chronic illness is that the Affordable Care Act specifically protects people with pre-existing medical conditions, like MS, and requires insurance companies to make health insurance available to them at the same rate as everyone else. Now, the most important thing to stress here is that nothing is changing right now. When the Federal Appeals Court issued its ruling, it sent the case back to the original Federal District Court in Texas, asking that judge to determine whether the Affordable Care Act could be considered constitutionally sound and stand on its own once the individual mandate was deleted. Well, this is the same judge who, in a prior ruling, had already declared the Affordable Care Act to be unconstitutional in its entirety. So you can be sure that ultimately, regardless of which way this particular federal judge rules, this case will be decided by the Supreme Court. Now, in the meantime, after the Federal Appeals Court issued its opinion, the National MS Society joined 16 other leading patient advocacy groups in issuing the following statement, and I'm quoting directly from their statement now. The Fifth Circuit ruling will cause more uncertainty for millions of Americans who live with serious, acute, and chronic health conditions and who rely on the Affordable Care Act to access comprehensive health coverage. The critical patient protections remain in place for now, including for people who just purchased health care for 2020. But the long-term viability of these essential protections continues to be at risk. Those protections include prohibiting insurance companies from denying coverage or charging more for coverage to people with pre-existing conditions, requiring health plans to offer essential benefits needed to prevent and treat a serious condition, and eliminating arbitrary dollar limits on coverage. Millions of Americans have benefited from these fundamental protections. Today's ruling continues to threaten the future of these basic protections and leaves those who rely on the law's benefits in a state of flux. On behalf of the millions of patients our organizations represent, we will continue to advocate for the quality care patients need and the lives that depend on this law throughout the legal process. Now, the patient groups that joined the National MS Society in issuing this statement included the American Cancer Society, American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, Global Healthy Living Foundation, Hemophilia Federation of America, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, the March of Dimes, National Alliance on Mental Illness, National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship, National Hemophilia Foundation, and the Kennedy Forum. So keep in mind that nothing is changing right now, and this battle continues into the new year. Canada has one of the highest rates of MS in the world. One out of every 385 Canadians is living with MS, and 11 Canadians receive a new MS diagnosis every day, with the majority of them falling between the ages of 20 and 49. My guest today is Mark Boyer. Mark biked from one end of Canada to the other, raising awareness of MS and raising over $160,000 to fund MS research. In just a moment, we'll meet my guest, MS warrior Mark Boyer. Mark Boyer doesn't have MS, but this past summer, Mark decided to bike more than 4,000 miles across Canada as a fundraiser for the MS Society of Canada, and I think that definitely qualifies him as an MS warrior. Welcome to the podcast, Mark.
Thank you very much, John. I mean, big word, warrior. I think it's more about enjoying life, and I have a chance to enjoy life, yes.
Well, I think that's a definition that a lot of other warriors would agree with, so I'm with you on that. Let's start at the beginning. What motivated you to take on a cross Canada ride?
So it's really two things. First, it's my best friend, my friend from high school, and he just, you know, gave me a call and said, "Mark, I would like to cross Canada," and he had a cause, and which he didn't know that my boss, Corey Turner, had MS, and it was more about his brother-in-law who has MS, but he did not accept to have MS, and he said, "I want to create awareness." And after he found out about my boss having MS, I said, "Okay, you're right, let's do this together." So that the main reason it started by my friend and creating awareness, which we believe in this project, and we can talk about in a bit deeper in this project, because it was a lot of fun to create awareness.
Well, I'm curious, before we get into the actual ride, are you or had you been a longtime cyclist? Had you done other long distance rides before?
These are great questions, because I am. I think I call that a good cyclist. I enjoy cycling long distances in summertime with my boys, because I have two cyclists in the family. I should say my daughter is also a cyclist, so let's say three cyclists in the family. But my best friend, not. He had to buy a new bike and get the training, I mean, for this big event. And him and I, we kept talking about it. I should say I coached him a bit, but he was able to really reach out to friends around and making sure that he was putting his legs to some good training to be ready. So I am a cyclist. He was not. But at the end, he did a fantastic job to be a cyclist.
This is a heck of an orientation to cycling, deciding to take off for 4,000 miles. How did he prepare for the ride? For some of our listeners who may not be ready to take that 4,000-mile bike ride, how do you train to do that?
So I think there's the biggest challenge you have, I don't think physically, because physically you can train your legs. You just train 2 to 3 times a week at the beginning, and after that you train 4 times a week and 5 times a week. You do some classes, and again you go by some climbing classes, or you go on your speed. And I think training the legs were pretty easy. It's more on the mental, where you have to think about, okay, we're going to go through some rain, we're going to go through some wind, we're going to go through some climbing, heavy climbing like the Rockies. And this is how we started to talk about the ride, and we were comfortable about physically we would be, I'm talking about the legs, we would be in good shape, and I think we were. It's more at the beginning, it's about sustaining every single day riding. And I'll be honest, as much as we thought it was going to be hard, just because of the country, we have a beautiful country, same thing in North America. It's a beautiful North America. But, I mean, when you cross the Rockies on your bike, as much as physically it might be tough, the scenery takes everything away. All the pain that you have, you just keep biking and you look around and you keep looking around. So I would say it was more a mental game than a physical game.
Well, that makes sense. So where did you start your ride?
We drove this beautiful RV to Vancouver, and we left Vancouver on June 8th to cross Canada to Halifax. And the reason we went from west to east, when you do your search a bit about riding Canada, it's easier to ride west to east, because the wind factor should be normally from the west, and you try to have the wind in your back, especially in the prairies. You pray the wind god to make sure it's behind you, not headwind. So it was well. Everything went well on that one.
So you went from Vancouver to Halifax. How long did it take you to complete the ride?
It was 73 days. That includes a day off every 5 to 6 days. And 73 days where, again, we had to different adventure, different places, different provinces and cities. And we had events in all major cities.
what was a typical day like during the ride? What was kind of the schedule, if you will?
At the beginning, it was a little challenge because you try to structure yourself. But let's say midway, we knew what we had to do. So a typical day would be getting up at 6 and breakfast, getting ready, and also looking at the weather. The day before, you look at the weather, making sure what's going to day going to look like tomorrow. And also, we had to look at the routes. And the evening was all the time about the routes. So getting up at 6, breakfast, getting ready, solid cream, whatever, and you go on your bike. And now we had a meeting point. We had a meeting point with the RV. And it was sometime, it depends. In the BC, it was more about short distances, like 15 miles. And when it was in the prairies, it was more about 30 miles or 40 miles. And again, we're trying to meet to just to make sure we have enough food or we had enough liquid with us because especially in July, it was very, very hot. And we had to make sure we were meeting the RV for the liquid because we were losing a lot of pounds, I would say, while riding across Canada.
I would imagine you were. If I can ask, how much money did you end up raising for the MS Society of Canada?
That I'm very proud, and I should say the team is very proud. We're going to end over $161,000. Our objective was $100,000, and Canadians are very generous. People are generous. It's a question of lucky enough when you cross Canada on your bike and you you have we had a beautiful jersey telling people who we were and what we were doing was nice. But more importantly, we have an RV. I don't know if you saw an RV. I can tell you it's a beautiful red RV with all the logos, the MS logo on it. And it was kind of the talking point because every time we were stopping at a campground, it was the talking point of people and people were coming to see us and asking us, okay, what exactly that is? And very short, I'll give you one of the best example. We were driving the RV up to Vancouver to get ready and we stopped for a quick lunch and a gentleman stopped us and says, what exactly is your RV and talk to me about MS and what is your implication about MS? And we told him about the ride crossing Canada and the gentleman gave us $1,000 on our website. We didn't know him and the main reason was he had his daughter just been diagnosed about MS. So for us, it started the right way about, you know what, we know we can create awareness and we know we can get this thing done. So it was very motivational, very, very.
What do you think was your biggest surprise during the ride?
I would say we have several things. The biggest surprise that people are generous. They are generous. Generally speaking, I would say to you, not that we were very surprised, but it was kind of saying they were gentle. They wanted to know. And all campgrounds, we had donations, all of them without exception. So it was pretty impressive about that. And the other surprise about it was about when you talk to people about what you're doing, we had more, you find out there's more people with MS. Or somebody knows that, oh, I know this person has MS. Or in my family, somebody has MS. So I never thought, neither my friend Yvonne, never thought that MS was that many people across Canada, and I'm sure in North America. But my point is, that was a kind of a surprise about, okay, there's every time we talk to someone, that person knows or the family is affected. So that was a big surprise for us.
Well, when you think about North America, you've got just over, 77,000 people in Canada who are living with MS. You have about 1 million people in the United States living with MS. I have this very unscientific opinion that everyone knows someone with multiple sclerosis.
I can attest that. I agree with your statement. We can without right now you haven't met my friend Yvonne or my brother-in-law Michel, they would say the same thing. I agree with your statement.
Aside from that quasi-insight that I tried to make there, and I'm glad you guys agree, was there a big takeaway? Did you learn something during the ride?
Yes, and I'm going to make it simple. We take everything for granted about life. And when you get up and you can ride every single day and you're healthy, but you know, first of all, you should say gratitude. And the learning, it's more about, we were able to cross Canada, stay healthy, create awareness, raise money, and we did it with all of our health, where other people would love to do the same thing, but we still take for granted to get up in the morning. We don't even say, wow, another beautiful day. And my friend and I, the first thing we were doing in the morning, every time we were taking off, and we were saying the same line every single morning, another day in paradise. And the why we were saying that word in paradise is because, again, we never take it for granted, taking off every morning on a beautiful day or a bad day to get on our bike to create awareness. We were so happy. And for us, it was about making sure that you don't take every day for granted. So it was a big, big thing for 3 months getting up and do this thing. It was a lot of fun.
Well, now that you have a Cross Canada ride under your belt, I have to ask, what's next?
Oh, my God. That's a beautiful question I've been asked probably many times. I still don't know, but one thing I can assure you, my friend and I would like to do something similar again. We don't know how long do we want to do again across Canada. We have not said no to that, but we did enjoy cycling a lot together, and we would be willing to look at any other challenge that people would like to work on with us. I think what's next is it's probably another bike ride, but I made a promise to my wife. 2020 will be her summer, not my summer. It will be her summer, so I'll spend some time with the family because I have 4 grandkids, and I want to spend some time with the family. But you don't know what 2020 will look like at the end of the year, or maybe 2021.
I have a feeling that when you're ready to ride again, you're going to find that there are a lot of people across North America who would love to ride with you.
And again, I think that's why I still haven't heard about what should be next. But I'm a strong believer that somebody's going to knock on the door and will review what the project will be and say probably yes to a good project, because my friend and I, we like to give back. When you're healthy, that's the first thing you should try to think of, is give back, because whatever you give, it'll come back to you. And you don't do this because it to come back to you, because it feels good. And it felt so good during 3 months to do that ride. I think I want to do it again. I want to make sure I do something similar where it's so good to give back. So, especially when you're healthy, right?
Right. Well, Mark Boyer, thank you for deciding to get on your bike and your friend to buy a bike to ride 4,000 miles across Canada and raise over $160,000. It's phenomenal. And thank you for that wonderful attitude of waiting for someone to knock on the door so that you can say yes. Thank you for all that you do. And thanks for talking with me today.
Pleasure, John. Thank you very much for calling too. Thank you.
This week's episode of Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And if you have a friend or family member who might also enjoy listening to the podcast, you can share this episode with them by suggesting they point their web browser to realtalkms.com/122. And you'll find that link in today's show notes so that it's super easy for you to copy and paste it right into your email or text. And please don't forget to visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app to your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the easiest way for you to connect to the podcast. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes, and it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. So I hope you'll take a moment and download the app today. And don't forget, if you have an Amazon Echo or Echo Dot at home, you can just say, Alexa, enable the Real Talk MS podcast. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next year.